world that doesn't consider pregnancy to be a high-risk situation for severe COVID. And I have had many pregnant women call me and say, I can't get this vaccine. So, of course, he's taking away vaccine for people. That's what he wants to do. And then he sits in front of Congress and lies about it.
So I want to go to this issue of access, because this is absolutely key. Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts questioned RFK Jr.
Will you tell America that all adults and all children over 6 months of age are eligible to get a COVID booster at their local pharmacy today?
Anybody can get the booster.
I'm sorry?
Anybody can get it.
Senator. Anybody. So you're saying that is now the official rule of HHS. Anybody is eligible to get a booster by just walking into the pharmacy.
It's not recommended for healthy people.
No. If you don't recommend, then the consequence of that in many states is that you can't walk into a pharmacy and get one. It means insurance companies don't have to cover the $200 or so cost. As Senator Dr. Cassidy said, you are effectively denying people vaccines.
We're not going to recommend a product for which there's no clinical data for that indication. Is that what I should be doing?
What you should be doing is honoring your promise that you made when you were looking to get confirmed in this job.
You're going
and
like this.
And that is, you promised that you would not take away vaccines from anyone who wanted them. You just changed the classification of the COVID vaccine.
I'm not taking them away from people, Senator.
It takes it away if you can't get it from your pharmacist.
Well, most Americans are going to be able to get it from their pharmacy for free. Most Americans will be able to get it from their pharmacy for free.
The question is, everyone who wants it, that was your promise.
No, I didn't. No, I never promised that I was going to recommend products with which there is no indication.
So that was Senator Warren questioning Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Can you clear this up, Dr. Paul Offit? You also had Senator Cassidy quoting Eric Erickson, saying his wife has fourth-stage lung cancer, and she couldn't go into her drugstore, very immunocompromised, and get the COVID vaccine.
I think Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has no idea what's going on the ground. I mean, it is now very hard to get vaccines for some people because, for example, pharmacies will always look to the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices for whether or not they're going to allow their pharmacists to give vaccines. The American, the ACIP, Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, still hasn't weighed in on COVID, so they're waiting. So many, many states now, you can't go to CVS and get a vaccine because we're waiting for the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices to say something. I don't think he has any idea the way this plays out. For example, there were data presented by the CDC when we still had a functioning CDC back in April where Fiona Havers said, looked at the last year for children. And what she found was that thousands of children were hospitalized. 1 in 5 were going to the intensive care unit. 150 children died. Half were previously healthy. Nonetheless, RFK Jr. 1 month later stands up and says, we're not recommending this vaccine for healthy young children, completely at variance with the data that were presented. And so the woman who presented that, Fiona Havers, left the CDC because she said they're just not paying attention to the data. And now the only vaccine that we have licensed for children less than 5 is only for high-risk groups, even though clearly children who are otherwise healthy and not in a high-risk group may be hospitalized. So he's made it more difficult to get vaccines because he's an anti-vaccine activist. Not at any point during that committee hearing did he ever say anything positive about vaccines. Not once.
I want to go to Fox. When Health Secretary Robert Kennedy attacked you, Dr. Paul Offit, directly, this was in June.
4 out of the 5 members who voted to recommend the rotavirus vaccine to this schedule had a direct financial interest in that vaccine. One of those individuals voted to add it to the schedule, and then he subsequently sold his vaccine. He owned and developed for this a guy called Dr. Paul Offit, sold his share, his patent on the vaccine for $186 million. So he said he won the lottery because of his vote.
Can you respond, Dr. Paul Offit, to Kennedy's accusation against you?
Okay, so I was on the advisory committee for immunization practices between 1998 and 2003. The vaccine on which I am a co-inventor with Stanley Plotkin and Fred Clark came up for a vote in 2006. So I had been off that committee for 3 years. So I didn't vote for the vaccine on which I was a co-inventor. Secondly, although I am a co-inventor with Stanley Plotkin and Fred Clark, I am the intellectual property of Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. They, for all intents and purposes, own that vaccine. So they're the ones who sold it out, not me. So I didn't make $186 million on that vaccine. I think I would have known about that. Mm.
And can you talk about being removed from, explain what the advisory committee is and what happened to you this week?
Right. So the FDA has its own advisory committee called VRBPAC, Vaccine and Related Biological Product Advisory Committee. I was on that committee for the first term between 2017 and 2021, then another four-year term between 2021 and 2025. And so I was, as far as I know, I was off the committee. But then one of the senior FDA officials wanted me to have another four-year term because they valued my expertise. So I agreed to do a two-year term. And then I was, you know, I was on the committee again for 2 years till 2027. But as you do another rotation, there's this pro forma series of forms you have to fill out for special government employees, the SGE forms. So I filled out those forms, sent them into the FDA. The FDA approved them. And then it went to HHS, Health and Human Services, where it got stuck. And it wouldn't release those forms out of Health and Human Services. I don't know why. I was never told why. I imagine Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had something to do with that because he doesn't seem to like me very much. So now I'm not on the committee. But I want to say this, unlike the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, where they fired 17 people, all of whom had an expertise and experience, and then replace them with people who didn't. So now we're not getting good advice from the ACIP. And now I think the medical and scientific community is ignoring the ACIP. That's not true with the FDA committee. There are great people who remain on that committee. I think that committee's advice is to be trusted. I think the fact that I'm not on that committee in no way hurts that committee.
I wanted to end in Florida, Dr. Offit. Florida plans to become the first state to end all vaccine mandates for children to attend school. Of course, well, everyone's going back to school this week, including for preventable diseases such as measles, mumps, chickenpox, polio, and hepatitis. In a news conference, the state's Surgeon General said the vaccine requirement is, quote, wrong and drips with disdain and slavery. The American Medical Association responded to Florida's plan to end vaccine mandates, saying it would, quote, undermine decades of public health progress. Your response as we wrap up.
So measles is the most contagious human infection. When immunization rates fray, measles comes back. There are two things that the public health community has to stop those kinds of outbreaks. One is quarantine of people who are sick, and two is vaccination. And so in the 1970s, even though school immunization requirements had been on the book for decades, they really weren't enforced. And there were these massive outbreaks in Los Angeles, in Alaska, in Detroit. Tens of thousands of children got measles, and about 160 died. So what they did, what those schools did is they mandated vaccines. They enforced those mandates. So you couldn't go back to school until you were vaccinated. And then that stopped those outbreaks. The Surgeon General, Joseph Ladapo, has now taken away that important tool to stop outbreaks. And I fear for the education of children in Florida, who now will probably start to miss more time from school and be less educated.
Dr. Paul Offit, I thank you so much for being with us, director of the Vaccine Education Center, physician in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. When we come back, the Trump administration's threatening to carry out more military attacks in Latin America under the guise of the war on drugs after the U.S. blew up a boat off the coast of Venezuela. President Trump, Defense Secretary Hegseth, have not provided evidence that it was a drug boat. In fact, some are wondering if it wasn't a boat carrying migrants. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning Yale historian Greg Grandin. Back in 20 seconds.
In the But when you
And oh, how I cried. I missed my water. My well ran dry.
Zeeshan B. covering You Don't Miss Your Water at our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As President Trump is set to sign an executive order to rename the Department of Defense the Department of War, his administration is threatening to carry out more military attacks in Latin America under the guise of the war on drugs after the U.S. blew up a boat off the coast of Venezuela.
You see it. You see the bags of drugs all over the boat, and they were hit. Obviously, they won't be doing it again. And I think a lot of other people won't be doing it again when they watch that tape.
The U.S. has deployed several ships, even a nuclear-powered submarine in the Southern Caribbean. On Thursday, U.S. officials said two Venezuelan military aircraft buzzed a U.S. Navy ship in international waters. This comes as senior Trump administration officials are refusing to provide proof of their claims that blowing up the boat in the Caribbean earlier this week because it was carrying drugs from Venezuela. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said he watched a live video feed of the operation, that the vessel targeted by the Pentagon was operated by the Tren de Aragua gang. But Hegseth provided no evidence. Venezuela's communication minister claimed the video was a fake made with artificial intelligence. In a New York Times report Thursday, an anonymous former senior federal law enforcement official said the attack was a significant change in U.S. anti-narcotics operations and that, quote, it was more likely that the vessel was carrying migrants on a human smuggling run. The official noted, quote, it would be impossible to know for sure, however, given that any evidence of drug smuggling was destroyed in the attack, unquote. Many experts believe the strike was illegal under both international law and domestic law. The attack came as Secretary of State Marco Rubio left for a trip to Latin America, where reporters asked if the Trump administration would seek congressional approval in the future for such strikes, but he didn't respond. Meanwhile, President Nicolas Maduro announced he'd mobilized over 8 million people into the National Bolivarian Militia to defend Venezuela against U.S. aggression. The U.S. recently doubled the reward for Maduro's arrest to $50 million and also accused him of being the head of the Cartel de los Soles. Rubio was in Ecuador Thursday after going to Mexico. He designated two more Latin American cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. For more, we're joined by Greg Grandin, history professor at Yale University, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His new book is America, America, A New History of the New World. So you have this boat filled with people, 11 people. Talk about what that indicates and what it means that the U.S. just blew it up in international waters.
Well, it was pure murder, and it was pure premeditated murder. It was 11 people in a go-fast boat. If you have that kind of boat, you're using it for drugs, you're not going to waste space with filling it with 11 people and laying it down with 11 people. You're going to want to use that space to carry the drugs. And it was premeditated because 11 people were summarily executed, and it's unclear where. There's no information, no intelligence, somewhere in the Southern Caribbean, somewhere near Venezuela. And it seems like this has been something that's been planned for quite a while. When Trump came into office, he issued a number of executive orders that declared cartels to be terrorist organizations and subject to military retaliation. On August 9th, the New York Times reported that he signed a secret order allowing the U.S. to use lethal action against criminals within Latin America, and this seemed like a very staged event that was basically a serial killer looking for a victim, and when they caught this boat I guess on satellite they gave the execution order and no bodies have been found. I mean, really, in many ways, it's bringing the logic of Gaza into the Caribbean in terms of unaccountability, impunity, and an expansive notion of national defense to justify what is, in effect, just extrajudicial killing.
And you have Marco Rubio, who is in Mexico, I believe, meeting with Claudia Sheinbaum, saying we're going to do it again and again.
Yeah, it'll happen again.
Who are the countries they're threatening, and who are they saying they will not attack?
Well, it's mostly Venezuela. And what's interesting about this is that it comes at a very interesting moment because there is a rift within the Trump administration between those who want to do business with Venezuela. Chevron just received a license to pump oil and sell it in the U.S. And that production just started a few weeks ago. And the first shipments of oil from Venezuela, variants on the sanctions placed on Venezuela have just gone through. But of course, Marco Rubio has opposed this for quite a while. Marco Rubio is leading the hardliners who basically want to use Latin America and, go hard against Cuba, against Venezuela. He's been obsessed about Venezuela, certainly during the first term as a senator. He exerted enormous influence on the Trump administration that led to the fiasco of Trump's foreign policy in Venezuela during his first term. And now he seems to be doing it again. He was in Ecuador. Ecuador is actually a country that does export quite a bit of drugs, more than Venezuela, into the Pacific. And it's a militarization of the drug war. And what's interesting about this is that most of Latin America's political class, including centrists and conservatives, former presidents like Ernesto, Cardoso in Brazil and Zedillo in Mexico, want the drug war wound down. And the United States is escalating it and folding it into the war on terror.
I was just reading the front page of the New York Times, without arrest or trial, killing drug suspects, pointing out what happens when you go after alleged drug suspects. Going back to 2001, Peru, CIA identifying for Peru a plane saying it was carrying drug smugglers. In fact, it was carrying American missionaries killed.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have Duterte, President Trump praising Duterte, former president, the former president of Philippines. Now he is sitting in The Hague, and he is wanted for crimes against humanity.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, Trump, this is exceptional. Without a doubt, this is an escalation and amplification of the United States' right to kill who it wants, when it wants, where it wants. But it is a long line. There is a long history of this. It started in the post-Cold War period. The U.S. escalated and claimed greater right for self-defense, expanded what they understood to be the notion of self-defense. When Reagan bombed Libya in 1986, he invoked Article 51 of the UN Charter, saying the United States was acting in self-defense because Libya was involved in a bombing of a Berlin disco in which a U.S. Marine was killed. Then you had, of course, the invasion of Panama, which was in 1991, which in many ways kind of echoes placing a bounty on Maduro's head, is just treating him a lot like they treated Noriega.
And what about, you're talking about this division within the Trump White House, the role of oil companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron?
Yeah, well, in many ways, it's a throwback to the 1930s when Royal Dutch Shell supported Paraguay and Standard Oil supported Bolivia and led to the Chaco War. Today, we have Exxon back in Guyana, formerly British Guyana, and Chevron backing Venezuela. And there's a border dispute. Venezuela, of course, has one of the largest deposits of crude oil in the world, something like an estimated 300 billion barrels of oil. And a lot of that spills out into what is Guyana, untapped area in Guyana. Exxon is operating in Guyana, supporting the Guyanese government, and Chevron is operating in Venezuela. So you're seeing the kind of this geopolitical tension between these two oil giants playing out, in the Caribbean, in the Southern Caribbean, and U.S. foreign policy kind of folding into it and escalating the conflict.
Let's end with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro speaking during a news conference this week.
8 military ships with 1,200 missiles and a nuclear submarine are targeting Venezuela. This is an extravagant, unjustifiable, immoral, and absolutely criminal bloody threat. They have wanted to escalate what they call maximum pressure, which in this case is military. And in response to maximum military pressure, we have declared maximum preparedness for the defense of Venezuela.
Your final comments, Greg Grandin.
Well, it really is brinkmanship. I mean, Marco Rubio is really pushing the envelope here. I mean, this morning we heard that Maduro sent a gaggle of jets to buzz over a U.S. ship. I mean,
in international waters.
I mean, this really could spill out of control in all sorts of ways. And of course, Rubio's goal is to basically tank the Chevron deal ultimately and topple Maduro and then Cuba.
Interesting that President Trump is signing the executive order today renaming the Pentagon the Department of War.
Yeah, I know.
Greg Grandin, Yale University history professor, Pulitzer Prize winning author, his latest book, America, America, A New History of the New World. When we come back, we go to Jakarta to look at the crackdown on mass protests. Stay with us. Musician Khaira Arbi performing in Democracy Now! Studios. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Indonesia, where at least 7 people are dead. Hundreds more have been injured amidst a crackdown on anti-government protests that erupted in the capital, Jakarta, a week ago before spreading across Indonesia. The uprising began with protests outside the parliament against salaries and housing allowances for lawmakers that are nearly 10 times the minimum wage in Jakarta. Protests spread nationwide after footage showed a paramilitary police unit using an armored vehicle to ram a group of protesters, killing a 21-year-old delivery driver. Protesters have since burned or ransacked buses, subways, and homes of several prominent politicians. For more, we go to Jakarta, where we're joined by Andreas Harsono, Indonesia researcher at Human Rights Watch, which has just published a report headlined Indonesia End Crackdown on Protesters, Arbitrary Detention, Investigate Excessive Use of Force, Tear Gas Against Demonstrators. Andreas, welcome to Democracy Now! Just lay out what developed this week. Start with the killing of the delivery driver and the response.
It started as a protest outside the parliament building because of the housing purge. It was on Monday last week, and then on Thursday night last week, the protest became much bigger. 64 labor union joined the protest, also university student. But that evening, around 7:20, a motorcycle taxi driver, you know, gig work, was hit, ran over by a police Barracuda vehicle. He died later in the hospital. But when he was hit, it was captured on video, and the video became viral, spreading all over Indonesia. In the next 4 days, there were protests, according to the Ministry of Home Affairs, more than 110 cities. Repeat, more than 110 cities all over Indonesia. Almost 50 were burning, unfortunately, arson attack. Parliament building, police station were burned down in Makassar, in Kediri, in Mataram, Lombok Island. So it was pretty big. And then President Prabowo and all party bosses met on Sunday. They agreed to cut the housing allowance, the controversial housing allowance. But also Prabowo said that these protests border on treason and terrorism. Police arrested more than 3,000 people. And then there are still protest leaders being arrested until today, charged with either inciting violence or the internet law, inciting people to protest against the government. That is the latest one. Right now, today, Friday, there are still protests. Yesterday, Thursday, there are still protests. Smaller, but there are still protesting, despite all the heavy presence of the military and the police in Jakarta and many other cities all over Indonesia.
What exactly is Human Rights Watch calling for right now, Andreas?
Basically, to end the excessive use of force. And Human Rights Watch also supported a United Nations calling the Indonesian government to have an independent investigation over the use of excessive force over the last 1 week in Indonesia.
I understand that the president, Prabowo Subianto, actually ended up going to, though he originally was canceling, his trip to China. The significance of this and Chinese President Xi Jinping expressing his appreciation and affirming support for Prabowo's governance.
It is. It is. He was supposed to join the meeting in Shanghai on economic affairs. He canceled it, but he still joined the military parade in Beijing, meeting President Xi Jinping and other world leaders, including Vladimir Putin, Kim Jong-un of North Korea, and many others.
And the significance of this, he clearly felt he could leave Indonesia. And where you think these protests and the crackdown with, what, more than 3,000 people arrested in addition to the deaths?
I think he felt confident that he can get the support of the military and the police to handle the political situations in Indonesia. He ordered to take strict measure against rioters, although he also promised freedom of expression, peaceful, can still be guaranteed in Indonesia.
If you could finally comment on the role of the economy, what's happening right now in Indonesia. I mean, this clearly has tapped a chord in Indonesia. And if you see the protests continuing, or will the crackdown suppress?
The underlying issue is economic inequality. Like what you said, the perk given to the parliament makers, the lawmakers, are 10 times from the minimum wage in Indonesia. And that is only for the housing allowance, not to talk about salaries and other allowances. So this is a grave concern. And we are still talking about regular lawmakers. We're not talking about their bosses or the other elite members of Indonesia. People are angry because their taxes are being increased, property taxes, added value taxes. But at the same time, they see that the political parties are more concerned about their lifestyle and also are more afraid to their party bosses rather than to be accountable to their respective constituencies. That is what makes people angry. Last but not the least, these motorcycle taxi drivers' death symbolize the difficulties that many Indonesians had faced, lost their job or need to supplement their income by working part-time or sometimes full-time, by doing motorcycle work, or to a lesser degree, also driving cars. And there are so many motorcycle taxi drivers all over Indonesia. They are so angry with the death of their colleague in Jakarta.
Andreas Harsono, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Indonesia researcher at Human Rights Watch. We'll link to your new report, Indonesia End Crackdown on Protesters, Arbitrary Detention, Investigate Excessive Use of Force, Tear Gas Against Demonstrators. Andreas was joining us from Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Berkman, Nate Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamara Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn.